Imagine building like a multi-billion-dollar digital fortress. You know, you've spent years learning from past failures. You've armed it with military-grade hardware encryption, and you've locked every conceivable door.
Right.
You were so confident that this system is impenetrable.
Yeah.
And then, well, someone breaches the entire thing using the interactive menu of a standard Blu-ray movie
I mean,
disc.
it sounds like a Hollywood script,
Yeah.
right? But that is the reality of modern hardware. We like to think of these enterprise systems as these impenetrable vaults, but extreme complexity always, always breeds vulnerability.
Yeah, totally. Well, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are exploring the ultimate cat and mouse game in modern cybersecurity, which is the PlayStation 5 jailbreak landscape, specifically spanning from 2020 to 2026.
It's a wild timeline.
It really is. And we're using this massive, comprehensive encyclopedia compiled by Tekken Game to break down this digital fortress.
Yeah.
So our mission today is to understand Sony's Prospero OS security, the absolute genius exploit chains that actually brought it down, and, the fascinating economic realities of console hacking.
And to set the stage here, I think it's crucial for you listening to understand that the PS5 isn't just a machine for playing video games.
Right.
From an architectural perspective, you are looking at a heavily fortified enterprise-grade computing system. I mean, it was designed from the raw silicon up to completely thwart unauthorized code execution.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can really talk about how this fortress was breached, we need to look at how it was built.
Right.
We're talking about architecture from the software all the way down to the physical microchips. So let's start with the operating system itself, Prospero OS. It's based on FreeBSD, branching from versions 12 and 14, right?
Exactly.
And they built it using a really strict system of privilege rings.
Yeah, so think of these rings as like levels of computational trust. At the very outer edge, you have user land or ring three,
The sandbox.
right? The sandbox. It's where your games run, it's
Yeah.
where the hidden WebKit browser instance lives, and where your party chat happens.
Got it.
Every single process here is trapped in its own isolated container. They can't talk to each other, and they certainly cannot directly map physical memory.
Okay, so that's the outer wall. Then you go a layer deeper to ring zero, which is the kernel space.
Yes.
And this is the core operating system handling the heavy lifting, right? Like memory paging, scheduling, communicating with device
Yeah,
drivers.
all the core stuff.
But the crazy thing is, even if a hacker manages to break into the kernel, they still aren't the boss.
Yeah.
And that's because of the level zero hypervisor.
Yeah, the level zero hypervisor is the real architectural game changer from the previous console generation. It is this autonomous, hardware-enforced virtual machine monitor that uses AMD's virtualization technology.
AMDV.
Right, AMDV. It literally encapsulates the kernel. And its primary job is enforcing something called WX.
Write XOR execute.
Exactly, right, XOR execute.
Meaning, basically, you can either write memory or you can execute memory, but you can never, ever do both at the exact same time. So if you write code, the system refuses to run it. And if you run code, the system refuses to let you alter it.
And that single mechanism right there completely kills traditional shellcode injection.
Wow.
Because in the early days of hacking, attackers would just, inject their own malicious code into writable memory and then tell the processor, hey, run this.
Right, just brute force it.
Exactly. But now, even if an attacker achieves ring zero kernel execution, the hypervisor strictly prohibits them from compiling and running arbitrary code in the system memory pools.
And it gets even crazier than that, because below the software, we hit the raw silicon. Sony partnered with AMD to build in the platform security processor, or the PSP.
Yeah, the PSP.
This is an isolated chip acting as a dedicated cryptographic coprocessor. So if I'm understanding this right, it's basically checking the hardware's DNA every single time it boots up.
Yeah, it uses one-time programmable silicon fuses. So these are literally hardware-burned cryptographic roots of trust straight from the factory. When you press the power button on the console, the initial boot ROM computes cryptographic hashes of the firmware. And if it detects a single altered bit,
Like just one bit.
just one microscopic one or zero out of place, the entire system halts immediately. It flat out refuses to boot.
Wow. Plus, even the memory itself is encrypted. Like they pioneered AMD Secure Memory Encryption, SME, right on the memory bus.
Yep.
So those old school hacks where people would physically sniff the RAM bus with voltage probes, totally useless now.
Completely obsolete.
And they use execute-only memory, XOM. Like, you can run system binaries, but you can't read them, meaning you can't just dump the kernel memory to reverse engineer it on your laptop.
Right, you're flying blind.
So if I'm visualizing this, it's like an ultra-secure casino.
Okay, I like that.
Userland is the casino floor. It's heavily monitored. Everyone is kept in their lanes. They're playing by the rules. The kernel is the management office in the back. But the hypervisor is the eye-in-the-sky camera system that physically stops anyone, even the management, from changing the rules of the casino games. That's the write XOR execute part.
Right.
And the AMD PSP is the vault that demands a DNA check before the building even unlocks its doors in the morning.
That is honestly a perfect way to picture it.
But that raises a massive question. I mean, if the hardware is literally checking its own DNA at boot, how do you even begin to attack it?
Well, what's fascinating here is that because the hardware and the hypervisor were so aggressively locked down, attackers realized pretty quickly they couldn't just kick in the front door.
Yeah.
They had to abandon direct attacks entirely and rely on indirect memory corruption. They had to look for these forgotten side doors buried deep inside really complex software subsystems.
So if the front door is physically impossible to break down, the only option left is to trick the system into opening a window from the inside. But how do they actually manage that?
By finding the most complex, legacy-ridden software on the console, and doing that required building an exploit chain.
Right, stringing things together.
Yeah, stringing together multiple vulnerabilities to achieve a larger goal. Because you need a userland entry point to escape that outer sandbox casino floor we talked about, and then you need a kernel privilege escalation to actually manipulate the core memory allocation structures.
The first major piece of this puzzle came from a legendary researcher named Andy Nguyen, widely known as The Flow, back in June 2022. He discovered the BDJB exploit, which that involves the Blu-ray drive, right?
Yes.
CZE-2022-31-City-89.
Yes. And this was a monumental paradigm shift because early hacks usually relied on hidden web browsers, but Sony heavily restricted those. So the FlowW looked at the console's optical drive subsystem instead, specifically the Blu-ray disc Java runtime.
Oh, man. Here's where it gets really interesting. So you buy a Blu-ray movie, and sometimes it has those interactive pop-up menus, right? Like director commentary, special features.
Yeah, exactly.
Those menus run on a lightweight embedded Java virtual machine that dates back to, like, standards created in the mid-2000s.
Right, the abstract window toolkit and the class loader. The Flow discovered that Sony had neglected to implement strict memory isolation between this old Java virtual machine and the underlying Prospero OS userland processes.
Oh, wow.
So by writing custom Java bytecode and literally burning it onto standard optical Blu-ray discs, researchers could feed the console weaponized heap spray arrays.
Okay, we definitely need to pause and translate heap spray for a second because it sounds like a garden tool.
Fair enough.
Basically, a heap spray is when a hacker forcefully crams the system's temporary memory, the heap, with massive amounts of their own malicious code, right?
Yes.
And the idea is that when the system gets confused and looks for instructions, mm-hmm. the memory is so saturated that it accidentally grabs the hacker's code instead of its own.
That is spot on. They flood the memory space so densely that the probability of the system executing the malicious payload becomes almost mathematically guaranteed.
So they just pop in a burned disk, completely offline, completely air-gapped from the internet,
yeah.
and they get arbitrary read and write access in the userland.
Exactly.
But honestly, I have to push back on this design a little bit. I mean, Sony built this military-grade silicon vault with hardware-encrypted memory buses and DNA-checking boot processes, but they left the window unlocked for a Blu-ray movie menu.
It is wild.
Like, why does a legacy media format like Java for a movie even require enough system access to compromise the user land in the first place?
Oh, it is a profound irony. But it's a known reality in software engineering. Any complex multimedia subsystem inherently harbors attack surfaces.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, to process high-definition video, audio streams, interactive menus, and anti-piracy protection all at once, the system just has to parse incredibly complex, often ancient code.
Right.
In fact, the Flow himself is quoted in our sources saying, you know, absolute security is impossible, and any executable subsystem will eventually reveal an entry point.
Okay, so they have userland access via the Blu-ray drive. Basically, they are standing in the casino management office.
Yes.
But they still need the kernel.
Yes.
And once again, the Flow delivers.
He really does. Analyzing FreeBSD's networking stack, he found a critical IPv6 use-after-free vulnerability, CVE-2021-4368.
Okay, so this use-after-free bug, if I'm understanding this right, let's go back to our building analogy. It's like a hotel checking a guest out of room 101, but forgetting to actually take their key back.
Right.
So the guest, or in this case, a hacker, just walks right back into his supposedly empty room and sets up shop. Is that what's happening in the memory?
That's a really great analogy. When the kernel deallocated network sockets checking them out of the hotel, it marked their memory descriptors as free or available.
Okay.
But it didn't immediately nullify the underlying pointers, so it left dangling pointers just looking at memory that was supposed to be completely empty.
So by flooding the network stack with precisely crafted socket control messages, hackers could reclaim these freed structures with their own controlled data. They're just squatting in all the empty hotel rooms.
Exactly. They hijacked the kernel's control flow. And by doing this, they completely bypassed KASLR.
Wait, KASLR?
Yeah. Kernel Address Space Layout Randomization.
Oh, which is basically the system constantly shuffling the row numbers in the hotel so a thief can't find the vault, right?
The exact concept. But because they hijacked the control flow through those empty rooms, they bypassed that randomization completely and achieved full ring zero execution.
Wow. And the combination of the Blu-ray Java trick and this IPv6 network trick birthed what the community calls the golden era on specific firmware versions, like 3.00 up to 4.51.
Yes.
It led to these incredible tools like KStuff and 8080 2.x.
And because of the hardware protections we mentioned earlier, how these tools operate is deeply impressive. They cannot permanently modify the encrypted read-only system partition on the SSD.
Because of the WX and the secure boot.
Exactly. So instead, frameworks like KStuff run entirely in volatile RAM. They dynamically intercept the kernel function responsible for authenticating binaries. They return a spoofed success code, and that allows unauthorized code to execute with native hardware access.
So it's basically a Jedi mind trick happening in real time in the RAM. Like, these are the authenticated binaries you're looking for.
Pretty much.
So every time you reboot the console, the memory wipes and the hack completely disappears. It's totally transient. But wait, if the console is successfully breached in this golden era, how does Sony react? Because back in the PS3 days, they went nuclear with lawsuits against hackers, which led to a massive hostile war and that catastrophic 2011 PlayStation Network data breach.
Yeah, they learned their lesson.
So this time, they didn't send lawyers. They sent money.
A very sophisticated strategic pivot by Sony. They instituted a massive bug bounty program on HackerOne.
Wow.
They effectively turned their potential adversaries into well-compensated security consultants.
We're talking up to $10,000 for critical user land flaws and a staggering $50,000 for critical kernel execution vulnerabilities.
Yep.
To date, they've disbursed over $2.5 million. But there's a catch, right? Responsible disclosure.
Right. If you take the payout, you agree to a 90-day embargo. You give Sony the blueprints to your exploit privately, and this allows Sony's security engineers to deploy mandatory firmware patches months before the exploit code can be weaponized publicly.
Okay, so if you've ever wondered why your PS5 suddenly forces you to download a mandatory system update before it lets you jump into an online multiplayer game, this bug bounty program is exactly why.
Exactly.
They are locking you out of older, vulnerable software versions. As a result, public jailbreaks remain structurally delayed. They only function on older firmware versions that lag like 6 to 12 months behind retail. It's like hiring the best bank robbers in the world to secretly install your new security system before they tell anyone else how they broke in.
It's highly effective. And they pair this with draconian network policies. If you attempt to authenticate with the PlayStation Network, you must prove you are executing the latest signed firmware.
Right.
And if their hardware-level telemetry detects anomalous runtime memory signatures, they issue permanent console ID bans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, blacklisting the physical motherboard worldwide.
And they enforce this using those microscopic silicon A fuses we talked about earlier. When you update your firmware, specific fuse arrays inside the AMD chip literally burn out.
Yes.
You physically cannot roll back the software. It is a one-way street enforced by melting microscopic hardware.
It's pretty brutal. And this aggressive patching brings us to an incredibly persistent myth in the gaming community, the deliberate backdoor theory.
Oh man, I love this one. So the idea is that Sony intentionally leaves these security holes unpatched to drive hardware sales.
Right.
Because people see sealed early firmware consoles selling for a 200% to 300% markup on secondary markets, and they think, well, Sony must be doing this on purpose to move units.
Yeah, that's the theory.
But wait, since scalpers sell these early firmware consoles for such a huge markup, doesn't Sony win anyway just because a box was sold?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture of console economics, that theory completely falls apart. Dedicated console ecosystems operate on the razor and blades business model. Sony makes very little, if any, profit on the physical hardware box itself.
Right.
The gross margin is often less than 5%, maybe $15 to $30 a unit.
So where is the actual revenue engine? Wait, obviously it's the games.
Exactly. Software licensing and services. Sony generates over 85% of its operating profit from the 30% platform fee on third-party digital software sales, microtransactions, and, you know, recurring PlayStation Plus subscriptions. A single legal consumer generates over $1,200 in lifetime software and service revenues.
That is a massive contrast.
Right. Now, if a consumer jailbreaks their console to execute pirated software, their lifetime software revenue contribution drops to exactly zero. From an enterprise balance sheet perspective, a jailbroken console represents an entirely dead capital asset. They lose over $1,100 in unrecoverable digital royalties per unit.
So Sony sees exactly $0 of that secondary arbitrage market where scalpers are selling old consoles.
Yeah.
The hardware profit is microscopic, and losing that 30% platform fee on software is, frankly, corporate suicide.
Absolutely.
Plus, they also have fiduciary liabilities to multi-billion dollar publishers, you know, like EA, Capcom, Ubisoft. If piracy runs rampant, those publishers will just migrate their games to competing platforms.
Tolerating piracy is mathematically disastrous for them. There is zero financial incentive to leave a backdoor open.
And while we are debunking myths, let's talk about the hardware itself. Mm. Because you hear these apocalyptic rumors on forums that jailbreaking causes thermal runaway, degrades the cooling system, or just straight up destroys the processor.
Right.
And I get why people think that. I mean, if you look back at the Xbox 360 or the PS3, those consoles were notorious for literally melting their own solder joints if pushed too hard.
The red ring of death.
Exactly. So people assume a hacked PS5 will just self-destruct.
But those claims are scientifically false in this generation. As we established, a PS5 jailbreak is a transient RAM-resident software payload. It does not alter the processor clock frequencies, it doesn't bypass the dynamic thermal throttling governors, and it doesn't elevate operating voltages.
And the custom liquid metal inside is incredibly efficient at moving heat, right? Like, way more than traditional thermal paste. It's got a conductivity of, what, 73 WMK?
Yes, exactly.
And it's physically sealed. Executing modified software imposes the exact same thermal dissipation profile on the processor as running an authentic retail disk. The operating temps are 100% identical.
The physical durability remains entirely determined by ambient room ventilation and factory assembly tolerances. Software payloads just cannot override the hardware-level thermal shutdown sensors.
So if it doesn't damage the hardware, but it guarantees you get permanently banned from the PlayStation Network, you lose all cloud save redundancy, and you can't play modern retail games because they require newer cryptographic SDK keys.
Mm.
Why do people even do it?
Well, this is where we have to look beyond piracy and examine the triumphs of the homebrew community. By unlocking supervisor execution privileges, independent developers are achieving milestones long neglected by commercial studios, specifically video game preservation and unauthorized performance optimization.
Oh, the absolute best example of this is Bloodborne, From Software's seminal 2015 gothic masterpiece.
Yes.
It has been locked at 30 frames per second for its entire existence. Mm-hmm. Fans have begged for an update for years. But on a jailbroken PS5, utilizing a custom patch by an independent developer named Lance McDonald, the game executes at a flawless native 4K resolution at a locked 60 frames per second.
And the technical feat behind this is astounding. When Lance performed a low-level binary analysis of From Software's proprietary engine, he found that physics calculations, character skeletal animations, and cloth simulation logic were hard-coded directly to a fixed 30 frames per second update interval.
Oh, wow.
This is known as delta time frame coupling.
Meaning, if you just uncap the frame rate naively, the entire in-game simulation suddenly runs at double speed. It would look like a fast-forwarded VHS tape.
Exactly. So to fix this, hackers had to literally disassemble the game's executable file, the eboot.bin, identify the primary update timing loops, and recalibrate the delta time multiplier to dynamically normalize physics ticks at 60 frames per second.
So what does this all mean? I want you, the listener, to think about the sheer dedication required to reverse engineer a compiled executable just to fix how a character's coat flaps in the wind.
It's incredible passion.
And they aren't just doing it for games. researchers have successfully booted complete Linux Fedora operating systems on the PS5.
Which is incredible because they transformed this lockdown console into a fully open computational workstation.
Right. The PS5 has a massive graphics processor. In PC gaming terms, it's equivalent to a very high-end graphics card capable of over 10.3 teraflops of raw processing power using Vulkan acceleration.
Yeah.
That's essentially supercomputer performance sitting in your living room, completely unlocked for custom software.
And this represents a profound debate over digital ownership. The homebrew community is performing the archival and optimization work that the industry often abandons. It proves that console exploitation isn't solely about commercial game piracy. It is deeply rooted in artistic preservation and pushing hardware to its absolute limits.
But again, you have to weigh the trade-offs. Because these privilege escalation exploits rely on manipulating delicate microsecond-sensitive memory race conditions, slight timing discrepancies inevitably trigger kernel panics.
Right.
The console just violently shuts down and has to completely reboot the SSD file system. You have zero cloud save backups. You are totally permanently isolated from the modern interconnected gaming network.
It is the ultimate choice between absolute software freedom over your hardware versus connection to the modern gaming world.
We've covered an insane amount of ground today. We started with Sony's impenetrable AMD Silicon Vault and the Level Zero hypervisor enforcing its strict write XOR execute rules.
And we explored the sheer genius of the flow exploiting the Blu-ray Java runtime and those dangling IPv6 socket pointers to orchestrate a complete kernel takeover.
And we confronted the harsh economic realities of Sony's microscopic hardware margins, the permanence of hardware fuses, and their brilliant strategy of using massive bug bounties to basically buy silence before exploits go public.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. The next time you boot up a console, remember what you're actually looking at. It isn't just a toy. It is one of the most sophisticated, violently contested pieces of cybersecurity hardware on the planet, where multinational corporations and elite hackers are fighting over microseconds of memory timing.
It's a digital battlefield hidden right there in your living room.
And it brings us back to that digital fortress, locked down with military precision, only to be breached by the interactive menu of a movie disc. It leaves us with one massive lingering question to ponder. With Sony now successfully using massive bug bounties to buy silence and hardware, it fuses physically burning away any chance of going backward. Will the future of video game preservation eventually become entirely dependent on independent hackers being richer than multinational corporations?